Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's start today with, yes, you guessed it, politics, but it's important, and especially important in the battleground state of New Hampshire. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks is here. He's been in New Hampshire this week, and he joins us now with some latest and interesting poll numbers from here at WBUR. Hi there, Anthony.
Hey, Meghna.
So BUR had a poll that looked at the presidential race. We'll talk about that in just a minute, but let's start with these just released numbers we have on the Senate race in New Hampshire between Republican incumbent Kelly Ayotte and Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan. What does the BUR poll find?
Yeah, and this is a really key race, as you know. So this is one of a handful of races around the country that could determine who gets control of the Senate. So the race has been a dead heat for a long time, and that's pretty much what the WBUR poll found. It gives the Democrat, Maggie Hassan, a two-point lead, 48% to 46% over Kelly Ayotte, the incumbent. That's well within the margin of error. The poll suggests that folks have pretty much made up their minds. Just 3% of them are undecided. So this race remains really close.
Wow, just 3% undecided.
Yeah.
Interesting. And what explains how close it is right now?
Well, Senator Ayotte and Governor Hassan are pretty much seen as the state's two most popular politicians by far. And if you look at our poll, they both have very high favorables, close to 50% each, though Hassan does a little better. They're both supported more or less equally by the state's independent voters. And they're both moderate. Ayotte is a kind of centrist Republican, Hassan a kind of centrist Democrat. So all that adds up to a dead heat in one of the country's key Senate races.
Wow, so it's going to be all about turnout. Well, yep. give us a sense as to what they're running on and if they're so close, how they're trying to distinguish themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting because they're sort of running campaigns that are mirror images of each other. Maggie Hassan is very much focused on national issues and she's trying to cast Ayotte as a tool of Washington special interest. She's happy to hitch her political wagon to Hillary Clinton. So here she is earlier this week at a Clinton rally at UNH in Durham, New Hampshire, going after Kelly Ayotte.
Wall Street special interests have given Senator Ayotte's campaign $2.5 million, and she has stood with their agenda in Washington. She voted against allowing students to refinance their loans while voting to slash $90 billion from Pell Grants, which would affect roughly 23,000 New Hampshire students.
So while Ayotte, Hassan's making this case that Ayotte is beholden to special interests, Ayotte accuses Hassan of being a rubber stamp for D.C. Democrats. And Ayotte, who was the state's attorney general before she went to the Senate, presents herself as an independent who's willing to reach across the aisle, buck her party's positions on certain issues, including on environmental issues. So here's a clip from one of her political ads.
As your attorney general, I fought to protect New Hampshire from out-of-state polluters. And I've done the same in the Senate, crossing the aisle to protect New Hampshire's clean air and water. Now supporting the Clean Power Plan, which will help address climate change with clean energy solutions that preserve our environment. And I believe we need to...
Okay, well, so all of this, Anthony, of course, is unfolding with a couple of names at the top of the ticket on the presidential race. How is that affecting the New Hampshire Senate race?
Interesting, in an interesting way, and again, in ways that reflect sort of opposite strategies. So Governor Hassan, happy to hitch her political fortunes to Clinton, as I mentioned. Ayotte has a bit of a problem with the Republican guy at the top of the Republican ticket, Donald Trump. She says she supports her party's nominee, but that she's not endorsing Trump. So it's a little bit of an awkward balancing act there. And one more thing about this race, Meghna, it's attracting a huge amount of outside money, close to $50 million so far. The AP says that number could exceed $100 million, which would be a record for any political race in the state of New Hampshire.
Wow, $100 million for a New Hampshire Senate race. Okay, well, so that's set the stage nicely for us to talk about the presidential contest in the Granite State. I mean, you've been spending a lot of time up there. WBUR's poll just out this week finds a 7-point lead for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. I mean, what stands out to you in the polling?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it's in line with a number of national and battleground state polls that have come out since Monday night's debate that have shown suggested that Clinton got a bit of a bounce post-debate. So it suggests that After watching her sizable post-convention lead over Trump all but disappear, Clinton has put the brakes on that and is gaining some ground. She now leads Trump 42% to 35% in New Hampshire. But consistent with previous polls, this one also identifies a big challenge for both candidates, and that is that neither of them are very well liked. 51% have a negative view of Clinton. 61% feel that way about Trump. The poll also shows that Clinton continues to build a really striking advantage among women. Almost half of them view her favorably. But get this, 70% of women view Trump unfavorably. 70%. So here's Steve Cozzella, president of MassInc Polling, which conducted the survey.
That translates into votes. You know, there's going to be a big gender gap, but it's the size of the gender gap, I think, that makes a difference. And when you see these numbers, how few women view him favorably, I think that's a real concern for him.
And Magna, finally, the poll also found that by a 3-to-1 margin, New Hampshire voters thought Hillary Clinton won Monday night's debate. That's also consistent with a number of other polls around the country.
Okay. Well, before we let you go, Anthony, tell us about this long-running feud that's been going on between Donald Trump and former New Hampshire governor, Republican governor John Sununu. That actually came to an end recently. So what's happened?
Yeah, this is an interesting story. So back in January, John Sununu, the former Republican governor and former chief of staff to George H.W. Bush, President Bush, warned voters against drinking the Trump Kool-Aid. Trump was happy to fire back, at one point tweeting that Sununu couldn't get elected dog catcher in New Hampshire. And here he is at a rally in Windham last January going after Sununu.
John H. Sununu has been known. He was fired by Bush. And he was fired like a dog. He was fired viciously. And he's such a dumb guy that he doesn't even know he was fired.
And here's John Sununu responding to that.
Trump has no substance, that he's all mouth, that his outburst today just shows another reason why he shouldn't be commander in chief.
And throughout the year, Sununu called Trump dumb, a political chameleon, a perpetual loser, among other things. But this week, John Sununu endorsed Trump, calling him the only candidate in this race who can bring bold change to Washington. So all is forgiven. The Kool-Aid's okay, apparently, Magna.
Yeah.
And it's worth noting that Sununu's son, Chris Sununu, is the Republican nominee for governor this year and has endorsed Trump.
Wow. I'm having images of a giant dancing red pitcher of kitty drink in my head at the moment. Anthony Brooks, WBUR senior political reporter, thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
Wellesley College is making a little history today. The famed Women's College inaugurated its 14th president. She's Dr. Paula Johnson, the first African-American president at Wellesley. Johnson has long been a groundbreaking leader in the field of women's health. She founded the Connors Center for Women's Health and Gender Biology at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and served as its chief of the Division of Women's Health. So why the jump to a college presidency? Well, we met with Dr. Paula Johnson at Wellesley earlier this year when the college first announced her selection.
It's a tremendous honor, and quite frankly, right now I'm just feeling all kinds of emotions of just overwhelming joy and pride. To be able to lead this amazing institution with its history, with its focus on educating women who make a difference in the world over generations. And where my life path has led me, which is focused on women, to kind of come to this point in my life is a dream come true.
Well, so what made this the right moment for you to transition into academic leadership on this scale?
You know, I have focused on in medicine, in women's health, and focused on women in general, improving their health, educating them, and really focused on their development. And this that journey, which has been a wonderful journey, got me really thinking and focused on higher education and really looking back a bit and thinking about the opportunities to shape the lives through the educational experience of young women. And I also was, you know, have done a lot of thinking about my own field of women's health, which is really taking biology and thinking about biology through a very different lens, and then combining it really with other fields, sociology, economics, and others. And if you think about that, those are so rooted in the liberal arts. And without a strong liberal arts base, the field of women's health would not exist. So it's the convergence of my long and deep interest and focus on women and thinking about this field and backing it up a bit and really becoming quite passionate about higher education and higher education for women.
Interesting, because, you know, on the trip over here, I was thinking that for so long you've been a vocal leader on exactly these issues that you were talking about. I mean, specifically, we were looking back at articles that you'd written about highlighting, obviously, health disparities between women and men, between people of color and white patients. And to be perfectly honest, in the field of healthcare, although there have been people who have been drawing attention to these disparities for quite some time, it feels as if only relatively recently it's become something that medicine and the healthcare field overall are talking about, and talking about in a way of like, what can we do about it? So I guess that's my way of asking, was this a difficult decision for you to make? Because it seems as if some of the work that you've been doing for so long, you know, healthcare itself is at a turning point, and you could actually maybe accomplish a great deal in terms of closing those disparity gaps between women and men, people of color, et cetera.
No, it's a great question. And, you know, if you think about where we are today, those differences, the disparities are highlighted. And we've done a lot of work, not only on the discovery side, the science side, but how do we also change the policies so that science is actually done differently, is performed differently? But it really takes young people who are thinking differently to make that change a transformational change, and to make that change one that is sustaining. And that in many ways is what excites me about Wellesley. As we think about educating our young women, allowing them and nurturing them to grow and to think critically, to think out of the box, to ask the questions that we haven't asked, that is exactly the kind of thinking we need to advance fields of science, medicine, and so many more in our country, in our world. And so in many ways, what I've worked on with my colleagues, who will absolutely continue the work and will continue to grow it, what we are now doing is ensuring that we are educating that next generation to, in fact, take it yet a step farther. And so in many ways, it's a natural continuation of the work I've really spent over my life.
I do want to get to your background a little bit more in a second, but it seems as if you're saying that there's also something unique that you yourself can bring to Wellesley, being, you know, being a physician, a scientist, to a historically liberal arts college.
I would hope so. And no, I do think that my background, once again, which is somewhat different, even in medicine, you know, I think bringing the field that we, with my colleagues, have nurtured, but also thinking about other fields, the field of public health. You know, health is influenced by the environment, and there are very significant sex differences. How do we begin to think about that lens and then bringing it to the policy side? There are opportunities to bring that framework to a liberal arts college in a way that allows young women to imagine opportunities for them that either exist today or even might not exist. The opportunities, the field that I'm in, didn't really exist in this way when I was in college. So for me, having a strong liberal arts education, really being encouraged to think differently, to think and to ask questions that, quite frankly, weren't being asked, really led to this work. So I think bringing my own experience, which is deeply rooted in the academy, gives me not only that lens, but I think it also gives me the lens of of really appreciating the academic culture, the deep commitment by the faculty to the Wellesley mission and to academic excellence. I think it gives me a lens from several directions. And there's one other area that I think is worth talking about, which is that, you know, the health of our students across the country is an area that many colleges and universities are looking at. And my experience in women's health, looking at sex differences, I think will also help me bring that expertise to Wellesley. You know, we know that rates, for example, rates of depression and anxiety in high school students are at an all-time high. And we also know that there are significant sex differences in how those disorders are experienced. Women, young women, having higher rates of depression, higher rates of anxiety. These are our students. How do we ensure that we create the healthiest environment possible so that when our students leave us and enter an ever-increasingly complex world, they are not only educated in the most traditional sense, but they are also leaving with a healthy body and a healthy mind. And I think when you think about all three of those, that is what launches our next generation in the most powerful way.
So there are many reasons that I'm sure that Wellesley is celebrating luring you over here. On the flip side of that, I imagine Brigham and Women's Hospital is weeping at your departure, over your departure. But if we could, let's talk for a moment about your sort of personal path, mm-hmm. if we could. Because I read that, so you grew up in Brooklyn.
I did. Before it was a cool place to live.
Yeah, before it was hip and impossible.
Right, in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and impossible
when
to afford to
live. When it was nearly bankrupt.
But I read that you didn't have, there weren't a lot of doctors in your family, or you didn't have any mentors in the medical field as a young person?
Oh, no.
How did you know you wanted to be a doctor, then?
It was interesting. So my mother was a school secretary, and she unfortunately passed away. I mean, it's one major regret of mine that she is not here to share this moment with me. I have a sister who's 3 years younger, and my father, who's 86, is still alive and will be here today. But I had, you know, although they were not college graduates, a very strong family, and my mother was incredibly committed to our education, to our independence, to our developing strong minds. And I didn't have any doctors in the family, but, you know, I unfortunately had my beloved grandmother, my mother's mother, suffered from depression, very serious depression over her life. And I saw that journey and saw what she faced. And I think just like many young people, when you see the adversity, you want to think about how might I be a part of the solution. And so I think very early on, that was part of what motivated me to want to be a physician.
Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit more about life growing up? Yeah. In Brooklyn?
So I grew up in a neighborhood. Back then it was called Flatbush. Now it's called Prospect Lefferts Gardens. It's the non-fancy side of Prospect Park. And went to public school, went to public elementary, junior high school, and high school. You know, my mother was extremely influential and important in finding the best schools that she could for us in the area. You know, I really wanted to go to a fine liberal arts college. And I was 15 when I started looking at colleges. I was 16 when I left, so I was very young. And I ended up coming here to Harvard Radcliffe.
Wow. I only say wow because 16.
Yeah, I was 16.
Oh, and then Harvard Medical School.
Yes.
And then you did your residency here
at the Brigham and Women's. Got a master's in public health as well during my medical school years. Took off some time, did that, and then trained in
cardiology,
internal medicine, and then cardiology, medical cardiology.
Okay.
And practiced in transplant. But my earliest work as an investigator, as a clinical investigator, was really understanding the sex and race differences in how patients experience symptoms of a heart attack and what the medical system does or doesn't do in response to those symptoms. So how do we better understand differences in presentation of illness between women and men and minority women? And then how do we think about the healthcare system's response, which then led to work on how do we change that system? And that's really the earliest roots of my work in women's health, which then at the Connor Center really is across all disciplines.
Your trajectory, regardless of your race or gender, has been phenomenal. You're an incredibly accomplished person. But as an African-American woman, I'm wondering, you know, were there challenges that you faced as you rose through the ranks in medicine?
There, you know, when you are in the minority, there always are. And I think that the sometimes the lack of seeing people like you in leadership, that's a gap. And there aren't many. And so for me, I think I've always been very cognizant of that, have looked for mentors, and I say mentors or people to bring into the fold from my own life. And it's usually not one, but many who serve different roles. But internalizing that and then understanding what it takes to lead either a division or the center that I lead, and internalizing those experiences and making sure that we really rethink how we lead. What is inclusive leadership? How do we ensure voices are heard? How do we ensure we pattern and model the behavior and allow people into our lives to understand what is possible for them? I think that's been a theme of my own leadership, you know, at Brigham and Women's, and I would hope, and at Harvard Medical School, and I would hope that that is a theme of my leadership. And I think what I would bring to Wellesley, as we think about how to make Wellesley, it's already committed to diversity, equity, inclusion, but as we think about even deepening those commitments, how do we bring my life lessons to my leadership here at Wellesley?
Wellesley President Dr. Paula Johnson speaking to us back in February. Today, Dr. Johnson was officially inaugurated as the first African-American president at Wellesley College. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.